For her fifth birthday in 1857, my great-grandmother, Georgia Taylor Allen, received a gift from her father, a five-year-old human being. The gift's name was Mary Jane Fairfield Hodges, Perlina Green Scott, but our family called her Aunt Mary. The two women were born in the days of slavery and died on the eve of the Civil Rights Movement within a few months of each other when both were 96 years old. In the last years of her life, Aunt Mary still wore her starched white maid's uniform and took her meals in the kitchen with the Negro help. She did not vote, eat in public places, or drink out of public water fountains. Since 1868, Aunt Mary had been guaranteed equal protection under the law, but she and Georgia Taylor Allen were not, in fact, protected equally, and they could scarcely dream equal dreams. Somehow the two shared a kind of companionship, one that I am still struggling to understand. It would be easy to say, looking back, that a friendship between two people of such unequal standing could only have been a sham, a one-sided, benevolent condescension quietly tolerated by Aunt Mary out of necessity. But what I saw as a child made me believe that the affection between them was sincere, if darkly complicated and ringed by barbed wire strictures of an unjust society. I never really knew Aunt Mary. When I was a little girl, she was old and unwell, so my memories of her center around the stories my family told. My mother's and my grandmother's generation spoke of her in reverential tones. They told me that the two women in their final months of life, during that time, Aunt Mary chose to sit in silent company with the woman she called Miss Georgia, her lifelong companion, former employer, and one-time owner. After Georgia died, Aunt Mary became too weak to leave her own house. My Aunt Annabelle delivered her hot meals every day to her home in Shake Rag, the black section of Tupelo, Mississippi. And at Aunt Mary's funeral in 1948, Aunt Annabelle stood up in the Shake Rag church and told the congregation, "Aunt Mary was our friend, and we loved her." Of course, it's impossible to ignore the fact that Aunt Mary would not have been welcomed at our family's church or at our dinner table on Sunday, or even to enter through the front door of a white person's house. And it never occurred to me as a little girl that by calling Aunt Mary by her first name only, we robbed her of her dignity. It is a mistake that I cannot rectify, except to change that practice now and by memories of her. To my knowledge, Aunt Mary, Ms. Scott, never spoke to any of us of race, status, or lack of opportunity while she worked in my Aunt Annabelle's house on Jefferson Street, considered one of the most distinguished streets in Tupelo. Nor did she mention the economic intimidation, violence, and lynchings that supported the absolute power of white society. But then again, how could she? Perhaps she felt free to speak of these things only in the quiet refuge of her neat, clapboard house in Shake Rag. Or maybe her circumscribed life had whittled away her sense of the possibility of any other kind of life, a defense against the pain of hoping for things that Southern society made impossible for her to achieve. Most likely, she had absorbed the sinister lessons of segregation and the violence that bolstered it and had learned how to survive in such a world by silently following its vile and malevolent rules. As I follow the recent resurgence of public discourse on race surrounding the Charleston tragedy, the Confederate flag controversy, and protests against heavy-handed policing that target minorities, I wonder what Ms. Scott would make of the current state of race relations in America. For that matter, I wonder what she would have thought of Brown v. Board of Education, the Voting Rights Act of 50 years ago last August 6th, or the election of President Barack Obama? Did she ever dream that her great-grandchild and Miss George's great-grandchild would sit together in school or stand in the same line to vote for a black president? Or did the boundaries of our society limit even her dreams? I sometimes wonder whether Ms. Scott learned not to dream beyond her reach to protect herself from the bitterness of unfulfilled longing. Or perhaps she had merely learned how dangerous it might be to share her wishes with us. I want to believe that Ms. Scott instinctively knew that black lives always mattered. They matter now, and they mattered then, even within a system built on hierarchies of caste, gender, and race, one that drew tight borders around the imagination and hopes of anyone not white and male, straight and Protestant. Ms. Scott's life mattered very much to my family and to her own family and to herself. But that life was tragically undervalued by the society of her day. And it was many years before I came to understand the ways in which my own family undervalued her because of our own myopic adherence to the right order of the era. At the time, Ms. Scott would have challenged that society at her peril. And I can only guess what she might think if she could see her great-grandchildren's generation today. I want to believe that she could put aside her fearful silence and feel proud of them for speaking their righteous anger out loud and dreaming bigger dreams than she ever could.